ruled for 3 decades as one of the world's most brutal and corrupt dictators, stealing billions of dollars in revenues from the nation's enormous deposits of diamonds, minerals, and strategic metals, slaughtering multitudes to preserve his power. During that time, he was the CIA's most trusted ally in Africa. Eisenhower's embrace of third-world dictators, indefensible as it was, paled in comparison to the most disturbing and potentially lethal aspect of his presidency. His buildup of nuclear weapons and dangerous reliance upon nuclear blackmail to gain advantage in the Cold War. He had deliberately blurred the line between conventional and nuclear weapons and was in the process of adding terrifyingly powerful thermonuclear weapons to the arsenal. No document condemned this policy more powerfully than the Russell-Einstein Manifesto of 1955. Initiated by philosopher-mathematician Bertrand Russell and enthusiastically supported by Albert Einstein, whose signature arrived in the last letter he wrote before his death, the manifesto was signed by 11 of the world's most prominent scientists, 9 of whom were Nobel laureates. Drafted by future Nobel Peace Prize winner Joseph Rotblat, it pleaded with passion and urgency. "We are speaking on this occasion, not as members of this or that nation, continent, or creed, but as human beings, members of the species man, whose continued existence is in doubt." The signers urged readers to think of themselves only as members of a biological species which has had a remarkable history, and whose disappearance none of us can desire. They explained, "All equally are in peril, and if the peril is understood, there is hope that they may collectively avert it." They expressed concern that most people still thought in terms of the obliteration of cities. Demolition of cities in an H-bomb war, they warned, is one of the minor disasters that would have to be faced. If everybody in London, New York, and Moscow were exterminated, the world might, in the course of a few centuries, recover from the blow. But now, with the capability of building bombs 2,500 times as powerful as the one used on Hiroshima, and the new knowledge of the widespread dispersal of lethal radioactive particles, the best authorities are unanimous in saying that a war with H-bombs might quite possibly put an end to the human race. It is feared that if many H-bombs are used, there will be universal death, sudden only for a minority, but for the majority, a slow torture of disease and disintegration. The signers asked, "Shall we put an end to the human race, or shall mankind renounce war?" They concluded with the words, "We appeal as human beings to human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you can do so, the way lies open to a new paradise. If you cannot, there lies before you the risk of universal death." Less than 1 week later, scientists meeting in Lindau, Germany, released the Maynard Declaration, signed by 18 Nobel laureates. Reaching out once again to all men everywhere, the declaration warned that, in an all-out war, the Earth can be made so radioactive that whole nations will be destroyed. Nations would either have to renounce force or they will cease to exist. Eisenhower and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles begged to differ, defying the opinion of most of humanity and insisting that recklessly brandishing nuclear threats was not only defensible, it worked. An early January 1956 interview in Life magazine quoted Dulles as saying that the Eisenhower administration had walked to the brink of nuclear war on 3 recent occasions and forced the communists to back down. U.S. resolve, he argued, had thwarted communist aggression in Korea, Indochina, and the Formosa Strait. Dulles's penchant for playing nuclear chicken produced a firestorm of controversy. Democratic Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn, deplored Dulles's pitiful performance. Adlai Stevenson accused Dulles of playing Russian roulette with the life of our nation. India's Hindustan Standard newspaper charged that Dulles's brinksmanship condemns millions of men to live in a state of perpetual fear and misery. 12 leading Protestant clergymen and editors of important religious journals wrote to Eisenhower, complaining that they were deeply shocked by Dulles's reckless and irresponsible policies. It remained for Mr. Dulles to tell a world aghast that the United States government 3 times came near the brink of annihilating the human race in an atomic Armageddon. As historian Richard Immerman has shown, Dulles's private views were more complicated. He understood the dangers posed by the increasing destructiveness of nuclear weapons, the challenges of Soviet nuclear parity, the growing international outcry against a policy that threatened human annihilation, and, as he told Eisenhower in April 1958, reliance on a strategy of massive retaliation that invoked massive nuclear attack in the event of any clash anywhere of U.S. with Soviet forces. But that did not stop the administration from again threatening China with nuclear attack in the second conflict over the disputed islands Kimoi and Matsu in 1958, as it had in the 1955 conflict, or from threatening the Soviet Union with nuclear retaliation during the Suez Crisis in 1956, when Israel, Britain, and France invaded Egypt following Nasser's nationalization of the Suez Canal. Vice President Richard Nixon drew dangerous lessons from the success of that strategy against the Soviets over Suez. In 1956, we considered using the bomb in Suez, and we did use it diplomatically. Eisenhower got Al Grunther, the NATO commander, to hold a press conference, and Grunther said that if Khrushchev carried out his threat to use rockets against the British Isles, Moscow would be destroyed as surely as day follows night. From that time on, the U.S. has played the dominant role in the Mideast. Nixon tried to repeat that performance during the 1970 Jordanian Civil War, in which U.S. allied King Hussein drove the Palestinian Liberation Organization out of Jordan. Democratic presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson emphasized the growing nuclear threat in his 1956 presidential campaign, insisting that he could not accept the apparent administration position that we are powerless to do anything to stop this headlong race for extinction, and calling Eisenhower's nuclear buildup madness. He pledged to push for an agreement to stop testing as his first order of business if elected. British, U.S., and Soviet tests in spring 1957 aroused international ire. Indian Prime Minister Nehru demanded an end to all nuclear tests, fearing that they might put an end to human life as we see it. The New York Times reported a worldwide concern that the continuation of tests poses a threat to the future existence of all living things on Earth. In November 1957, following a new round of tests, the National Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy placed an ad written largely by Norman Cousins in the New York Times. Signed by 48 prominent citizens, it called for an end to nuclear testing as the first step towards arms control. The unexpected public response to the ad sparked the formation of a major national anti-nuclear organization, popularly known as SANE. SANE was only one of several initiatives launched in 1957. The first Pugwash conference was held in Nova Scotia in July. Participating scientists from all over the world, including 5 from the United States and 3 from the USSR, called for abolishing war, ending the arms race, and halting nuclear testing. Reacting to the public outcry, Eisenhower began a campaign at home and abroad to promote what he called the peaceful atom, building on the momentum generated by his December 1953 UN address. The Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, marketed nuclear power not only as a protector against godless communism, but as a magic elixir that would power transportation vehicles, feed the hungry, light the cities, heal the sick, and excavate the planet. The U.S. Postal Service issued a stamp celebrating Atoms for Peace, to find the way by which the inventiveness of man shall be consecrated to new life. In late April 1955, Eisenhower unveiled plans for an atomic-powered merchant ship that would visit ports all over the world to show the United States' commitment to a just and lasting peace. In July, the United States generated its first commercial nuclear power. In October 1956, Eisenhower announced that Atoms for Peace was succeeding. The United States had agreements with Japan and 36 other nations to build atomic reactors and was negotiating with 14 more. Meanwhile, the United States was proceeding with the development of an atomic plane, but a proposed $60 million atomic-powered Coast Guard icebreaker proved too costly, and Eisenhower vetoed it. By 1958, the United States was becoming almost giddy with the prospect of something even more ambitious, grandiose, and absurd. Planetary excavation under the AEC's Project Plowshare. In September 1957, the AEC detonated a 2-kiloton bomb inside a mountain in Nevada. Willard Libby, who had replaced the independent-minded Henry Smith as the only scientist on the AEC in 1954, reported in December that radioactive fallout from the Rainier test had been entirely contained within the mountain, making possible a broad range of peaceful uses for atomic explosions. Libby exulted, "I've not seen anything in years so exciting." AEC Chairman Louis Strauss understood the real purpose of the program. In February, he admitted that Plowshare had been intended to highlight the peaceful applications of nuclear explosive devices and thereby create a climate of world opinion that is more favorable to weapons development and tests. The New York Times reported on its front page on March 14th that atomic explosions up to 10 times the power of the World War II Hiroshima bomb may be within a couple years an everyday occurrence almost anywhere in the country, under a program being pressed by scientists of the Atomic Energy Commission. In June, the AEC announced Project Chariot, a plan to create a 300-foot harbor in Alaska north of the Arctic Circle with 4 hydrogen bombs. Officials anticipated that the bombs would be used to free inaccessible oil deposits trapped in both tar sand and shale formations. Similar explosions could also create huge underground reservoirs, produce steam, desalinize water, crack copper, and other impenetrable ores, and produce radioactive isotopes for use in medicine, biology, agriculture, and industry. Experts wanted to blast a new, bigger and better Panama Canal. Some wanted to alter weather patterns. Jack Reed of the Sandia Laboratory in Albuquerque proposed exploding a 20-megaton bomb alongside the eye of a hurricane to reverse its course. He was confident that any resulting radioactivity would fall harmlessly. A U.S. Weather Bureau scientist, Harry Wexler, proposed a plan to accelerate melting of the polar ice caps by detonating 10 10-megaton bombs near the Arctic Circle, which he calculated would warm the polar area by approximately 10 degrees Fahrenheit. The AEC doubled the Plowshare budget for 1960. Almost 100 staff members at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory were slated to work on the project. Physicist Edward Teller, who directed the lab, was extremely enthusiastic about the prospects. But the project hit a snag. In September 1958, Eisenhower had yielded to domestic and international pressure and announced that the United States would go along with a Soviet-initiated nuclear test moratorium. To continue the project, Eisenhower would have had to defy the moratorium. He pressed the Soviets for an agreement allowing peaceful tests. When it looked as though the Soviets might be yielding, he approved plans for a 10-kiloton explosion deep in a salt bed near Carlsbad, New Mexico, in summer 1959. Project Gnome, as it was called, would explore the feasibility of creating an underground reservoir of heat that would remain trapped in melted salt and could be used to produce electricity. The blast would also yield valuable radioisotopes that the United States would attempt to recover for medical purposes. A spokesman for the Interior Department, whose National Park Service ran the nearby Carlsbad Cavern National Park, reported that the department was completely flabbergasted by the announcement. Project Chariot was to follow in summer 1960. Some citizens even came up with their own suggestions for worthy projects as part of Plowshare. One woman suggested that the AEC use hydrogen bombs to kill all the snakes in Africa. Despite the administration's aggressive effort to promote the peaceful atom, public awareness of the dangers of nuclear testing was increasing rapidly. In April 1957, Nobel Peace Prize winner Albert Schweitzer added his voice to the growing international chorus of people demanding the cessation of nuclear testing. Schweitzer broadcast his Declaration of Conscience to approximately 50 countries. The New York Times reported worldwide concern that the continuation of tests poses a threat to the future existence of all living things on Earth. A May Gallup poll showed that 63% of Americans favored an international halt to bomb tests, more than double the 27% who opposed such a move. Just the previous fall, only 24% had supported Stevenson's call for a test ban. The publication, a few months later, of Neville Shute's riveting novel, On the Beach, which was serialized in the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and other papers, added fuel to the fire. The novel described the aftermath of a 37-day nuclear war in which 4,000 cobalt bombs were exploded, tracing the final days of the last surviving pocket of humans in Melbourne, Australia, as the radioactive cloud was descending on them. Earl Brown's review in the Washington Post, titled The Facing of Certain Death, with a heading above it, Atomic Armageddon of 1960s, began, Neville Shute has written the most important and dramatic novel of the atomic age, and if you read only one book a year, this should be the one. Brown concluded, I hope Neville Shute's book will go into a few cornerstones or time capsules, so that if an atomic Armageddon ever comes, future civilizations may realize that this generation went down the road to destruction with its eyes wide open. It should be required reading on both sides of the curtain. Winston Churchill was attending a party at Lord Beaverbrook's villa in Cap d'Ia, France, in September 1957. When guests began discussing Shute's chilling novel, Churchill announced plans to send a copy to Khrushchev. Someone asked if he was also planning to send one to Eisenhower, to which Churchill replied, It would be a waste of money. He is so muddle-headed now, I think the Earth will soon be destroyed. And if I were the Almighty, I would not recreate it in case they destroyed him too the next time. Stanley Kramer's film version premiered simultaneously in all the major capitals of the world in December 1959 to unprecedented international fanfare. New York Times reviewer Bosley Crowther concluded his glowing assessment of the film with the observation, The great merit of this picture, aside from its entertainment qualities, is the fact that it carries a passionate conviction that man is worth saving after all. Eisenhower's cabinet discussed ways to counter the film's powerful nuclear abolitionist message. Officials in the cabinet, AEC, and State Department attempted to discredit the film by alleging that it contained serious errors that invalidated its central premises. The U.S. Information Agency created a file titled Possible Questions and Suggested Answers on the Film On the Beach. But the numerous filmgoers, many of whom left the theaters in tears, were probably more impressed with the simple, straightforward repudiation of deterrence theory offered by Julian, the scientist ably played by Fred Astaire, who was asked who he thought started the war. He responded, Who would ever have believed that human beings would be stupid enough to blow themselves off the face of the earth? When his questioner persisted, Julian explained, The war started when people accepted the idiotic principle that peace could be maintained by arranging to defend themselves with weapons they couldn't possibly use without committing suicide. Everybody had an atomic bomb, and counter-bombs, and counter-counter-bombs. The devices outgrew us. We couldn't control them. I know. I helped build them. God help me. Somewhere some poor bloke probably looked at a radar screen and thought he saw something, knew that if he hesitated 1/1,000th of a second, His own country would be wiped off the map, so he pushed a button and the world went crazy. And... The film's details might have been wrong, but its understanding of the world Eisenhower had helped create was not. One could certainly paint a more benign portrait of Eisenhower's nuclear policies. After all, he resisted the Joint Chiefs' pressure to use nuclear weapons. He limited civil defense expenditures and restrained the growth of overall defense spending. He worked to enact a test ban. He resisted pressure for a massive buildup after Sputnik. He confronted the powerful and sometimes hostile Soviet Union while trying to hold the NATO alliance together. And he was often a voice of moderation in the midst of far more hawkish and extreme advisers. Yet, under Eisenhower, the United States went from having a little more than 1,000 nuclear weapons to approximately 22,000, aimed at 2,500 targets in the Soviet Union. But even the 22,000 figure is misleading. Procurements authorized by Eisenhower continued into the 1960s, making Eisenhower responsible for more than 30,000 nuclear weapons during the Kennedy administration. Between 1959 and 1961, the United States added 19,500 nuclear weapons to its arsenal. The United States was producing new weapons at the rate of 75 per day, and doing so at bargain basement prices. As Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Rhodes notes, nuclear warheads cost the United States about $250,000 each, less than a fighter bomber, less than a missile, less than a patrol boat, less than a tank. Total megatonnage increased 65-fold in 5 years, reaching 20,491 megatons in 1960. In pure megatonnage, that was the equivalent of 1,360,000 Hiroshima bombs. Although the total megatonnage began to drop in 1961, as 950 10-megaton B-36 bombs were retired, the bomb's destructive capability actually increased as the introduction of ballistic missiles made targeting more accurate. Doubling the accuracy of delivery allows for an 8-fold reduction in yield without sacrificing the bomb's destructive capability. What is little known is that Eisenhower had delegated to theater commanders and other specified commanders, including the Strategic Air Command and NORAD, the authority to launch a nuclear attack if they believed it was mandated by circumstances and were out of communication with the president, or if the president had been incapacitated. With Eisenhower's approval, some of the theater commanders had in turn delegated this authority to lower commanders under similar circumstances. This sub-delegation included commanders of numbered air forces, fleets, and navies. Thus, there were dozens of fingers on the triggers, if not more. According to RAND analyst Daniel Ellsberg, who had discovered the dangerous circumstances surrounding delegation and sub-delegation during his studies of nuclear command and control for the Pentagon, it was a doomsday machine on a hair trigger with delegation. And given the fact that there were then no locks on nuclear weapons, many more people had the actual power, if not the authority, to launch a nuclear attack, including pilots, squadron leaders, base commanders, and carrier commanders. During the next decade, locks were put on nuclear weapons in Europe and then on tactical nuclear weapons. Locks on SAC bombers came much later. No locks were put on submarine missiles until the 1980s, meaning that any submarine commander still had the power to wipe out the USSR. In August 1960, President Eisenhower approved the preparation of a national strategic target list and single integrated operational plan, PSYOP. The country's first PSYOP detailed a plan to deploy the country's strategic nuclear forces in a simultaneous strike against the Sino-Soviet bloc within the first 24 hours of a war. Its goal was maximum destruction. The targets included Soviet nuclear forces, government control centers, and the urban industrial base. When briefed on the magnitude and redundancy of destruction, Eisenhower admitted to his naval aide Captain E.P. Orand, that it frightened the devil out of me. As well it should have. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were subsequently asked to estimate the death toll from such an attack. The numbers were shocking. 325 million dead in the Soviet Union and China. Another 100 million in Eastern Europe. A similar number in Western Europe from fallout. And up to another 100 million from fallout in bordering countries including Finland, Sweden, Austria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Japan. Those figures did not include the deaths caused by Soviet nuclear weapons or by U.S. tactical weapons. Nor did they include the then unknown fact that an attack of this magnitude would almost certainly have triggered a nuclear winter, raising the possibility of extinction. Though horrified by the prospect of millions dying if the PSYOP were enacted, Eisenhower passed the plan, unaltered, on to the new administration. Having justified this precarious, one might say insane, nuclear buildup as the price of keeping defense spending down, Eisenhower's FY 1960 federal budget had increased by only 20% over his first budget, despite a nearly 25% rise in GNP over that time period. The Eisenhower years were relatively peaceful and prosperous, but many Americans feared that the country was stagnating and hungered for a new dynamism. Democrats turned to the youthful Bostonian, John F. Kennedy. Kennedy hailed from a prominent and politically ambitious family. His father, the controversial Joseph Kennedy, was a successful Wall Street speculator and major financial backer of Franklin Roosevelt. His stint as ambassador to Great Britain was cut short because of his appeasement policy toward Hitler and his open pessimism about Great Britain's prospects in the war. Elected to the Senate in 1952, John Kennedy's congressional career offered little indication of the heights to which he would later rise. A Cold War liberal, he supported Richard Nixon's red-baiting congressional campaign against the progressive Democrat Helen Gahagan Douglas. Illness enabled him to miss the December 1954 Senate vote of censure against Joseph McCarthy, an old family friend whom he had avoided criticizing. Alluding to the title of Kennedy's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage, Eleanor Roosevelt said she wished that Kennedy had a little less profile and a little more courage. His brother Robert had even served on McCarthy's staff. Kennedy tried to win the support of the Eleanor Roosevelt Adlai Stevenson liberal wing of the party, but never gained its trust. His opportunistic, though politically astute, choice of Lyndon Johnson as running mate confirmed the liberals' mistrust of him. Kennedy defeated Nixon by the narrowest of margins in 1960. Nixon had touted his vice presidential experience and strong contribution to the Eisenhower administration. But when a reporter asked Eisenhower to name an important decision Nixon had participated in, Eisenhower said that if you gave him a week, he might think of one. Kennedy positioned himself as the candidate of change. But not all the changes he promised were positive ones. Running as a hawk, he criticized the Eisenhower-Nixon administration for tolerating Castro's takeover in Cuba and for allowing a dangerous missile gap to develop. On some level, Eisenhower understood the potentially cataclysmic situation he had created and regretted the virtual doomsday machine he had bequeathed to his successor. He was deeply disappointed that pressure from hawkish scientists and military advisors had thwarted his efforts to conclude a test ban treaty before leaving office. With that in mind, he delivered an extraordinary farewell address, whose warning about the rise of an increasingly powerful and threatening military-industrial complex not only flew in the face of his actual track record as president, but described a phenomenon whose growth Eisenhower had personally masterminded. This speech, the best remembered of Eisenhower's presidency, originated in conversations between the president's chief speechwriter, Malcolm Moose, a Johns Hopkins political scientist, and Ralph Williams, a retired Navy captain who was also on the speechwriting staff. Moose and Williams met on October 31, 1960, to discuss ideas for the farewell address and agreed that it was necessary to expose the problem of militarism. Williams's memo spelled out their concern very clearly. For the first time in its history, the United States has a permanent war-based industry. Not only that, but flag and general officers retiring at an early age take positions in a war-based industrial complex, shaping its decisions and guiding the direction of its tremendous thrust. This creates a danger that what the communists have always said about us may become true. We must be careful to ensure that the merchants of death do not come to dictate national policy. The specific phrase, military-industrial complex, which the speech immortalized, was apparently suggested by physicist Herbert York, the former director of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. In 1971, while working for the summer at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, York told a younger American colleague that he had been the one to suggest the precise wording to President Eisenhower for insertion into the speech. Eisenhower agreed and sounded the tocsin. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. For most Americans, the significance would not be understood for a long time, but there were some notable exceptions. Walter Lippmann astutely compared Eisenhower's farewell address to George Washington's. As Washington had warned about the foreign menace to civilian power, Eisenhower warned about the domestic military menace. Eisenhower considered Washington his hero. In At Ease, Eisenhower shared the fact that Washington's farewell address exemplified the human qualities I frankly idolized. The New York Times' Jack Raymond provided a full-page analysis of the military-industrial complex, replete with graphs detailing the exorbitance of U.S. defense spending, which accounted for 59% of the nearly $81 billion national budget. In addition to spending half the federal budget, he noted, the Pentagon also controlled $32 billion worth of real estate, including air bases and weapons arsenals. Raymond explained how the military and industry worked hand in glove to achieve this. The United States' excessive militarism, he added, was hurting the nation's image abroad. In carrying a big stick, the United States appears to have forgotten the other part of Theodore Roosevelt's dictum, to speak softly. Kennedy's close advisor and biographer Theodore Sorensen later mused, "I think that the principal reason Kennedy ran for the presidency was he thought the Eisenhower Dulles policy of massive retaliation and all of that was heading the country toward nuclear war. He felt the policy of massive retaliation, in which we supposedly kept the peace by saying, if you step one foot over the line in West Berlin or somewhere else, we will respond by annihilating you with nuclear weapons. He felt that was mad. But little in the 1960 presidential campaign would have led observers to believe that Kennedy was going to reduce the risk of nuclear war, or that the new administration would do anything other than fuel U.S. militarism. Kennedy attacked Eisenhower's willingness to place fiscal security ahead of national security, especially at a time when the Soviets would soon be able to outproduce the United States 2-3-1 in missiles. During the campaign, Kennedy acknowledged that he didn't expect the Soviets to use that lead to threaten or launch an attack upon the United States, but he wouldn't take any chances. Calling for increased defense spending, he declared that those who oppose these expenditures are taking a chance on our very survival as a nation. Kennedy's inauguration was resplendent with symbolism. 86-year-old Robert Frost became the first poet ever to participate in a presidential inauguration. Marian Anderson, the talented singer whom the Daughters of the American Revolution had once barred from Constitution Hall because of her race, sang the national anthem. And Kennedy delivered a ringing inaugural address that both reached out to the Soviet Union in hopes of building friendship before the dark powers of destruction unleashed by science engulf all humanity, and welcomed the fact that his generation had been granted the opportunity to defend freedom in its hour of maximum danger, and would pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship in order to do so. The new administration recruited establishment insiders from the leading foundations, corporations, and Wall Street firms, and leavened them with a sprinkling of progressives in secondary positions. David Halberstam labeled them the best and the brightest, chronicling how their intelligence, achievements, and can-do spirit combined with hubris and profound moral blindness to land the United States in Vietnam. They were typified by National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy, the Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard, who had been the first applicant to get perfect scores on all three Yale entrance exams, and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, who was renowned for his computer-like mind and managerial brilliance. During a SyncPAC meeting on materials in the pipeline to Vietnam, McNamara stopped the projector and accurately complained that the data in slide 869 contradicted what had been presented 7 hours earlier in slide 11. The intelligence of Kennedy's advisors was never in question. Their judgment, however, was. John Kenneth Galbraith, who served as Kennedy's ambassador to India, regretted that foreign policy was still with the Council on Foreign Relations people. We knew their expertise was nothing. All they knew was the difference between a communist and an anti-communist. They had this mystique, and it still worked. And those of us who doubted it were like Indians firing occasional arrows into the campsite from the outside. As a result of this odd mix of arrogance and ignorance, the new administration blundered badly in foreign policy right from the start. Kennedy proceeded with Eisenhower's plan to have the CIA secretly train an invading force of 1,500 Cuban exiles in Guatemala. When he initially expressed doubts about the wisdom of such a scheme, Allen Dulles assured him that an invasion would inspire anti-Castro Cubans to rise up and overthrow the government. Administration officials Chester Bowles, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and Richard Goodwin took sharp issue with the plan, and Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair J. William Fulbright urged Kennedy to abandon it entirely. But the new and inexperienced president feared blocking an operation backed by Eisenhower and the Joint Chiefs. 3 days before the operation was set to begin, 8 U.S. B-26 bombers destroyed or incapacitated half of Castro's air force. The invading force arrived at the Bay of Pigs in 7 ships, two of which belonged to the United Fruit Company. The Cuban army easily subdued the invaders, who begged for direct U.S. military assistance. The promised popular uprising never materialized. Bundy, Rusk, and Kennedy himself had repeatedly made it clear to CIA officials that no air support would be forthcoming. They knew that such an action would damage the United States' image abroad and invite a Soviet move against West Berlin. Shortly before midnight on April 18th, Kennedy, Johnson, McNamara, and Secretary of State Dean Rusk met in the White House with General Lyman Lemnitzer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Navy Chief Admiral Arleigh Burke, and the CIA's Chief of Clandestine Services, Richard Bissell. Burke and Bissell spent 3 hours trying to persuade Kennedy to send ground and air support. They had known all along that that was their only hope of success, and fully expected that Kennedy would cave in to their pressure. Kennedy said, They were sure I'd give in to them and send the go-ahead order. It was inconceivable to them, Kennedy's advisor Walt Rostow later wrote, that the president would let it openly fail when he had all this American power. Lemnitzer charged that pulling out the rug was unbelievable, absolutely reprehensible, almost criminal. But Kennedy stood strong. As he explained to an old friend, "We're not going to plunge into an irresponsible action just because a fanatical fringe in this country put so-called national pride above national reason." 114 men were killed, 1,189 captured. Among the casualties were four U.S. pilots under contract to the CIA from the Alabama National Guard. The post-mortems started quickly. The Chicago Tribune put it succinctly. "The main results of the supposed Cuban invasion are that the Castro dictatorship is more firmly installed than ever. The communists have made hay all over the world, and the United States has taken a dreadful kick in the teeth." The Wall Street Journal declared that, "The U.S. finds itself in a sorry mess. This country is reviled around the world. But we suspect that the deeper feeling, especially in the capitals of international communism, is one of astonishment at U.S. weakness." The New York Times fretted that U.S. hegemony in the Western Hemisphere is threatened for the first time in a century, as the Cuban Revolution offered a model for the rest of Latin America. The world was indeed shocked by the United States' ineptitude and misjudgment. Dean Acheson reported from Europe that the fiasco shattered the Europeans, who saw it as a completely unthought-out, irresponsible thing to do. They had tremendously high expectations of the new administration, and they just fell miles down with a crash. Bowles wrote in his diary, "The Cuban fiasco demonstrates how far astray a man as brilliant and well-intentioned as Kennedy can go, who lacks a basic moral reference point." Bowles would soon be unceremoniously ushered out of the State Department. Kennedy took responsibility for the botched invasion, but vowed to redouble his efforts to combat communism. "We dare not fail to see the insidious nature of this new and deeper struggle. We dare not fail to grasp the new concepts, the new tools, the new sense of urgency we will need to combat it, whether in Cuba or South Vietnam. The message of Cuba, of Laos, of the rising din of communist voices in Asia and Latin America, these messages are all the same. The complacent, the self-indulgent, the soft societies are to be swept away with the debris of history. Let me then make clear as President of the United States that I am determined upon our system's survival and success, regardless of the cost and regardless of the peril." Democratic Senator Al Gore Sr., who was a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, called for a shake-up of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. All the members should be replaced by new, wiser, and abler men. The New York Times placed the lion's share of blame on the CIA and called for the agency's thorough reorganization. Cuban exiles blamed the mission's failure on Kennedy's refusal to provide air support. Most of them would never forgive him. But despite the broad-based criticism of his handling of this affair, Kennedy's overall approval ratings jumped to the highest level of his presidency, leading him to comment, "It's just like Eisenhower. The worse I do, the more popular I get." The entire sordid affair had a profound effect on the inexperienced president. Kennedy developed a healthy skepticism toward military advisors and intelligence officials. He explained to Schlesinger, "If someone comes to tell me this or that about the minimum wage bill, I have no hesitation in overruling them. But you always assume that the military and the intelligence people have some secret skill not available to ordinary mortals." Kennedy told journalist Ben Bradley, "The first advice I'm going to give my successor is to watch the generals and to avoid feeling that just because they were military men, their opinions on military matters were worth a damn." Kennedy's post-invasion remarks seemed to reveal the first flickering of understanding of Eisenhower's poignant warning. But his learning curve would need to be a steep one for him to escape the steel trap of Cold War thinking. Following the botched invasion, Kennedy decided to shake up the Joint Chiefs' sons of bitches and those CIA bastards. He threatened to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. He named General Maxwell Taylor to replace Lemnitzer as chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but, hoping to placate hawkish critics, chose Curtis LeMay as Air Force Chief of Staff, a decision he would come to regret. At the CIA, he replaced Dulles with conservative Republican businessman John McCone. He also forced the resignation of Deputy Director Richard Bissell and Deputy Director General Charles Cable. He placed all CIA agents and other overseas U.S. personnel under the local ambassador and took steps to cut the CIA budget, shooting for a 20% reduction by 1966. Kennedy put his brother Robert in charge of a significant portion of covert operations. The new responsibility kept the youthful Attorney General very busy. Under his watch, the CIA launched 163 major covert operations in 3 years, only 7 fewer than had been conducted under Eisenhower in 8 years. Before assuming his new position, General Taylor conducted an inquiry into what went wrong in the Cuban operation. General Walter Bedell Smith testified, "A democracy cannot wage war. When you go to war, you pass a law giving extraordinary powers to the president. The people of the country assume when the emergency is over, the rights and powers that were temporarily delegated to the chief executive will be returned to the states, counties, and to the people." Smith thought that the CIA's usefulness might have come to an end, and a new covert agency was needed. He remarked, "It's time we take the bucket of slop and put another cover over it." Kennedy's growing mistrust of his military and intelligence advisors made it easier to rebuff their pressure to send troops to Laos, something that Eisenhower had warned him might be necessary to defeat the communist Pathet Lao. "If not for the Bay of Pigs," Kennedy told Ted Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger Jr., "it probably would have happened." The Joint Chiefs insisted that Kennedy give prior commitment to a large-scale invading force and approval for taking the war to China if necessary, even if it meant using nuclear weapons. Kennedy resisted such demands and angered the generals by opting for a neutralist solution. After the Bay of Pigs, Schlesinger told David Talbot, Kennedy had contempt for the Joint Chiefs. He dismissed them as a bunch of old men. He thought Lemnitzer was a dope. Still reeling from the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy prepared meticulously for his June meeting with Khrushchev in Vienna. Khrushchev had earlier reached out to the new president, hoping to ease tensions and reach an accord on nuclear testing, Laos, and Berlin. But now the mood had darkened. During the summit, the Soviet premier bristled with accusations. Khrushchev berated the young president for the United States' global imperialism. He declared that U.S.-Soviet relations hinged on resolution of the German question and deplored Germany's remilitarization and prominence in NATO. He demanded a treaty recognizing 2 separate Germanies by the end of the year. Berlin would function as a free demilitarized city under East Germany's jurisdiction with guaranteed access from the West. Kennedy's parting comment to Khrushchev was, "I see it's going to be a very cold winter." He told one reporter, "If Khrushchev wants to rub my nose in the dirt, it's all over." George Kennan thought that Kennedy was strangely tongue-tied during the summit. The browbeaten president sat down afterward with James Reston, who asked, "Pretty rough?" Kennedy responded, "Roughest thing in my life." He explained, "I've got 2 problems. First, to figure out why he did it, and in such a hostile way. And second, to figure out what we can do about it. I think he did it because of the Bay of Pigs. He thought that anyone who was so young and inexperienced as to get into that mess could be taken, and anyone who got into it and didn't see it through had no guts. So he just beat hell out of me. So I've got a terrible problem in trying to make our power credible, and Vietnam looks like the place." It would have been easier for Kennedy to comprehend Khrushchev's belligerence if he had understood the depth of Soviet concerns about Germany. These went well beyond the placement of U.S.-controlled intermediate-range ballistic missiles, IRBMs, on German soil, and beyond the flood of East Germans escaping through West Berlin. What really terrified Khrushchev was the prospect of Germany getting control over its own nuclear weapons. He threatened to sign a separate peace treaty with East Germany and cut off British, French, and U.S. access to West Berlin. Khrushchev explained to an American journalist, "I can understand how Americans look at Germany somewhat differently than the way we do. We have a much longer history with Germany. We have seen how quickly governments in Germany can change, and how easy it is for Germany to become an instrument of mass murder. It is hard for us even to count the number of our people who were killed by Germany in the last war. We have a saying here, give a German a gun, sooner or later he will point it at Russians. This is not just my feeling. I don't think there's anything the Russian people feel more strongly about than the question of the rearmament of Germany. You like to think in the United States that we have no public opinion. Don't be too sure about this. On the matter of Germany, our people have very strong ideas. I don't think that any government here could survive if it tried to go against it. I told this to one of your American governors, and he said he was surprised that the Soviet Union, with all its atomic bombs and missiles, would fear Germany. I told your governor that he missed the point. Of course we could crush Germany. We could crush Germany in a few minutes. But what we fear is the ability of an armed Germany to commit the United States by its own actions. We fear the ability of Germany to start a world atomic war. What puzzles me more than anything else is that the Americans don't realize that there's a large group in Germany that is eager to destroy the Soviet Union. How many times do you have to be burned before you respect fire? The failure to bridge differences over key matters in Vienna made for one of the tensest summers in the Cold War. Dean Acheson, who prepared the background papers on Germany for the summit, advised Kennedy to take a strong, uncompromising stand on Berlin and avoid negotiations. He felt that nuclear war was worth risking. In the event of a confrontation, the United States planned to send a few brigades to Berlin. If the Warsaw Pact resisted militarily, the United States was ready to launch an all-out nuclear attack. As Bundy explained to Kennedy, "The current plan calls for shooting off everything we have in one shot, and it is so constructed as to make any more flexible course very difficult." At a special meeting on July 20th, Lemnitzer and other military officials briefed Kennedy on plans for and consequences of nuclear war. Lemnitzer reviewed a report detailing a surprise attack on the Soviet Union for late 1963. Kennedy asked what would happen if the attack were launched in late 1962. Alan Dulles responded that the United States would not have enough missiles available until December 1963. Kennedy asked how long, if war occurred, would U.S. citizens have to remain in fallout shelters. 2 weeks, he was told. He ordered that no one present even disclose the subject of the meeting. Deputy Secretary of Defense Roswell Gilpatrick reported that Lemnitzer gave the briefing as though it were for a kindergarten class. Finally, Kennedy got up and walked right out in the middle of it, and that was the end of it. In his 1990 memoirs, Dean Rusk described Kennedy's reaction. "President Kennedy clearly understood what nuclear war meant and was appalled by it. In our many talks together, he never worried about the threat of assassination, but he occasionally brooded over whether it would be his fate to push the nuclear button." In September, Lemnitzer briefed Kennedy, McNamara, and Rusk on PSYOP 62, including the option for a full-scale preemptive attack against the Soviet Union. Afterward, Kennedy disgustedly said to Rusk, "And we call ourselves the human race." Despite his reservations, Kennedy intensified the crisis. On July 25th, he addressed the nation. "The immediate threat to free men is in West Berlin, but that isolated outpost is not an isolated problem. The threat is worldwide. We do not want to fight, but we have fought before, and others in earlier times have made the same dangerous mistake of assuming that the West was too selfish and too soft and too divided. The source of world trouble and tension is Moscow, not Berlin. And if war begins, it will have begun in Moscow, and not Berlin." Kennedy announced an additional $3.45 billion for defense, an increase in draft calls to make possible a 25% expansion in the size of the army, activation of select reserve and National Guard units, and a national program to construct fallout shelters, both public and private. He emphasized the need to be prepared for nuclear war and reminded citizens, "Now in the thermonuclear age, any misjudgments on either side about the intentions of the other could rain more devastation in several hours than has been wrought in all the wars of human history." The Warsaw Pact nations responded in dramatic fashion, implementing changes that had been under discussion for months. On August 13th, East German troops began erecting barbed wire barricades and roadblocks to shut off the stream of escaping East German citizens. Construction workers soon replaced the barbed wire with concrete. Kennedy sent 1,500 U.S. troops by road from West Germany to West Berlin, where they were met by Vice President Johnson. The world teetered nervously on the brink of war. 18-year-old James Carroll waited at the Pentagon to pick up his father, Joseph Carroll, who had just been appointed the director of the newly created Defense Intelligence Agency. Carroll, who would later win the National Book Award for his powerful memoir, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us, vividly recalled his father's unsettling words. "Tonight, Dad is in a somber mood," he wrote. "He is smoking, flicking ashes out the window. He has said nothing. Finally crushes the cigarette in the dashboard ashtray and turns to me. Son, I want to say something to you. I'm only going to say it once, and I don't want you asking me any questions, okay? You read the papers. You know what's going on. Berlin. The bomber they shot down last week. I may not come home one of these nights. I might have to go somewhere else. The whole air staff would go. If that happens, I'm going to depend on you to take my place with Mom and the boys. What do you mean? Mom will know. But you should know, too. I'll want you to get everybody in the car. I'll want you to drive south. Get on Route 1, head to Richmond. Go past it. Go as far as you can before you stop." He didn't say anything else. Neither did I. We must have driven the rest of the way home in silence. I do remember very distinctly what I felt. Fear. Despite all the talk of war, I had believed that my father and the others like him, Curtis LeMay, Tommy White, Pierre Cabell, Butch Blanchard, our neighbors on General's Row, would protect us from it. Now I saw that Dad himself no longer thought they could. I felt my father's fear, which until then I thought impossible. I began to be afraid that night, and I stayed afraid for many years, first of what our enemy would do, later of what we would do. When recounting the story more than four decades later at a conference on the nuclear threat in Washington, D.C., Carroll concluded with the words, "And I have been driving south ever since." The Berlin Wall diffused the immediate danger, enabling Khrushchev to back off his threat to sign the provocative treaty with East Germany. Kennedy confided to aides, "It's not a very nice solution, but a wall is a hell of a lot better than a war." Khrushchev understood the West's vulnerability in Berlin, which he viewed as the testicles of the West. "Every time I want to make the West scream," he said, "I squeeze on Berlin." Khrushchev found another way to make Kennedy scream in August 1961. He resumed nuclear testing. When Kennedy learned it would soon happen, he erupted, "Fucked again." His advisors urged him to hold off responding in kind so that they could score a propaganda victory. But Kennedy brushed them off, exclaiming, "What are you, peaceniks? They just kicked me in the nuts. I'm supposed to say that's okay?" Kennedy's warnings during the Berlin crisis infused the debate over fallout shelters with a new sense of urgency. Recommendations to build shelters during the 1950s had largely fallen on deaf ears. In March 1960, Representative Chet Holyfield, who chaired the Government Operations Subcommittee, declared civil defense to be in deplorable shape, with only 1,565 home fallout shelters having been built in 35 states. Few people could afford or were willing to spend the several thousand dollars it cost to have the shelters installed in their homes. Nobel Prize-winning UCLA nuclear expert Willard Libby, a former member of the Atomic Energy Commission, proposed a solution. To much fanfare, He built a shelter at his Bel Air, California home for $30 and lectured. If your life is worth $30, then you can afford a fallout shelter such as this. Libby dug a 5-foot-wide, 5-foot-deep, 7-foot-long hole into the side of a hill. He lined the sides, top, and entrance with 100 dirt-filled burlap bags. He made the roof from 16 8-foot-long railroad ties. Unfortunately for the Libbys, a fire swept through the Santa Monica Mountains in February 1961, destroying their home. Mrs. Libby had time to salvage only 2 items, her husband's Nobel Prize and a mink coat. After initial reports that the fallout shelter had survived intact, the Washington Post sadly reported, "Fire wrecks Libby's Bel Air fallout shelter." The timing was regrettable. Newspapers were currently running Libby's multi-part series titled, "You Can Survive Atomic Attack." Physicist Leo Szilard commented that this proves not only that there is a God, but that he has a sense of humor. To an outside observer, it might have seemed that Americans had taken leave of their senses in the summer and fall of 1961, as the nation conducted an extended conversation about the ethics of killing friends and neighbors in order to protect the sanctity, security, and limited resources in one's own home fallout shelter. In August, Time magazine published an article titled, "Gun Thy Neighbor," which quoted one Chicago suburbanite as saying, "When I get my shelter finished, I'm going to mount a machine gun at the hatch to keep the neighbors out if the bomb falls. I'm deadly serious about this. If the stupid American public will not do what they have to do to save themselves, I'm not going to run the risk of not being able to use the shelter I've taken the trouble to provide to save my own family." At public meetings, neighbors with shelters told next-door neighbors and best friends that they would shoot them if necessary. Clergy weighed in on both sides of the issue. Reverend L.C. McHugh, a former professor of ethics at Georgetown, fueled the controversy when he wrote in the Jesuit magazine America, "Think twice before you rashly give your family shelter space to friends and neighbors, or to the passing stranger. Others trying to break in may be repelled with whatever means will effectively deter their assault. Does prudence also dictate that you have some protective devices in your survival kit, e.g., a revolver for breaking up traffic jams at your shelter door? That's for you to decide, in the light of your personal circumstances." Right Reverend Angus Dunn, the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C., denounced the every-family-for-itself approach as immoral, unjust, and contrary to the national interest. He averred that the kind of person who would be most desperately needed in a post-attack world is least likely to dig himself a private molehole that has no room for his neighbor. Many people took sad note of the ways that the Cold War and threat of annihilation had warped the American conscience. Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists editor Eugene Rabinowitz called home fallout shelters pathetic and viewed discussions of killing one's neighbors as demonstrations of human depravity. Historian Gabriel Kolko said that government neutrality on the gun thy neighbor debate suggested that it would not complain when shelterless neighbors removed their armed neighbors' shelter filters or slip a plastic bag over the air intake. The New York Times reported on one satirical cabaret skit in which shelter owners were encouraged to shoot their neighbors now rather than wait until they tried to break into their shelters. Bob Dylan recorded a song intended for his The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan album titled "Let Me Die in My Footsteps." The unreleased song began, "I will not go down under the ground, 'cause somebody tells me that death's coming round. And I will not carry myself down to die. When I go to my grave, my head will be high." For the chorus, Dylan sang, "Let me die in my footsteps before I go down under the ground." In perhaps the most creative response, one protester showed up at the Jesuit publication's office with an umbrella labeled "Portable Fallout Shelter." An arrow pointing to the end opposite the handle read, "For Stabbing Shelterless Neighbors." Despite government pressure, surprisingly few Americans actually built fallout shelters, apparently recognizing that shelters would offer scant protection in the event of nuclear war, or that such a war might not be worth surviving. Still, the chilling specter of nuclear war hung over the first 2 years of the Kennedy presidency. Having won the election in part by exploiting the fear of a missile gap, once in office, Kennedy asked McNamara to quickly ascertain just how big the gap was. It took only 3 weeks to confirm that a gap did exist, but it was in the United States' favor. Kennedy wanted to keep that information from the public. He intended to exploit the apocryphal missile gap to justify a robust increase in defense spending. But on February 6th, his politically inexperienced Secretary of Defense shocked reporters by announcing, "There's no missile gap." McNamara offered to resign over this faux pas. Kennedy explained that all such judgments were premature, and the issue faded quickly. But in October 1961, Kennedy decided to come clean on the striking disparity between U.S. and Soviet military strength. He authorized Gilpatrick to publicly flaunt the United States' superiority in a speech to the Business Council in Hot Springs, Virginia. The speech was carefully crafted by young RAND consultant Daniel Ellsberg. Gilpatrick announced that the United States has a nuclear retaliatory force of such lethal power that an enemy move which brought it into play would be an act of self-destruction.